What's happening, family? And welcome to the In the Black of My Mind podcast. My name is Al Thomas, and this is episode 12. It's actually part two of The Freaknik Lawyer. If you haven't seen part one, you may want to go back and check that out. And do me a favor, tell everybody to subscribe and like and share. Share this with everybody. How many bodies? Everybody's. We want everybody to be watching In the Black of My Mind podcast. So let's go on and get started. Where's the intro? You get involved working with the college students. The Freaknik.
I tell you how that happened. I had listened to the news. I had heard one evening after a day's work, sitting around a dinner table with my family, and the television news was on, and the mayor came on and said that the students were no longer welcome in the city because the year before when they had come, this would have been 1995, so in 1994 when they came, so many came, and they were in their cars, and they just sort of jammed up the highway. Hmm. And so the emergency vehicles, the ambulances, and couldn't get to their calls. The fire engines couldn't get to their calls, and the police couldn't get to their calls. And so the mayor says something has to happen. They're not welcome to come, and if they come and violate city ordinances, we're going to arrest them. Mm. I didn't think that was right. So when I went to work the next day, I contacted the president of the Gate City Bar Association. I think I was president-elect and would have been the president the following year. Mm-hmm. So I contacted the leadership and said, well, I don't think that's right to arrest these kids. Number one, they probably are not going to get the word in time. And number two, those who get the word, they're probably not going to believe that the black mayor of the city of Atlanta, which they call the black Mecca,
right,
was going to throw them in jail for coming to town to have some fun. And so they're probably coming. And I asked if we could set up a volunteer committee of lawyers who would undertake to represent these kids pro bono, for free that is. Mm-hmm. And get them out of jail and get them resolve their legal issues and get them back to school before classes on Monday. And the board said, okay, fine, that seems like a good idea, let's do it. And so we had a press conference, and media came out, and we made the announcement, and two things happened. Well, number one, we drew the ire of the mayor of the city of Atlanta, who thought that we were trying to thaw his program. Mm-hmm. And then we had a number of lawyers, mostly black lawyers, who agreed to come in and volunteer that weekend to get kids out of jail who had been arrested. And then I was contacted by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Mm-hmm. Their legal office had contacted me and said, well, we want to help. And so what we will do is have people on the ground, particularly around the Atlanta University Center, where students primarily congregated before they hit the streets. And as students were arrested, we will then provide that information to you, and you can go in and interview them and start your work. Mm-hmm. As the date became closer, Ozell Sutton, you may know that name, he was in charge of the Justice Department Community Affairs Division. At least he was the regional director for the Southeast region The Justice Department Community Relations, Community Affairs Department. I had worked with Ozell Sutton doing boycotts and marches in Macon, Georgia, before moving to Atlanta. So mm-hmm. in my early 20s, after my Tuskegee experience, when I had gone back home, I was very active in community organizing. And so Ozell Sutton would come down to Atlanta, and wherever there was a hot spot, his job was to come in and put the flame out. So I had met him in the early mid-1970s in Macon, mm-hmm. when he had come down to put out the hot spot when we had organized these marches and drew the ire of white citizens of Macon, and that was thought that there might be some trouble. So then Ozell Sutton, sensing that there would be trouble, in fact, Sutton was present two doors, I think he lived two or three doors down from the room where Martin Luther King Jr. was registered in at the Lorraine Motel, that fateful visit in April of 1968 when he was assassinated.
Right.
And he was there monitoring the situation, seeing if the Justice Department need to come in and do something to quell the urban unrest that had happened the previous week when Martin was in town. Mm-hmm. So the Justice Department sent him to Memphis. And so I guess his bosses alerted him that maybe he should be a little vigilant because the mayor's rhetoric was very stern, and that might be trouble in the streets of Atlanta. So Sutton agreed to allow his office to be command central for the SLC operation. And so I met with Sutton and I met with SLC, and we had the plan, you know. So they SLC posted up in Sutton's office, and I posted up in the jail. And so that's how that all came about. And what would happen as the weekend progressed, as the SLC learned that there had been someone arrested, they would call me in the jail and say, see student so-and-so and so-and-so, the name is so-and-so, they were arrested for it, for as you know this. Then I would go and ask to see that person. And of course, that was probably the first time all of those kids had ever been arrested, and they were free, didn't know what to do and didn't know how, what they really did to get into jail for the first time. And so I would, where I couldn't get bond immediately, you know, I would just let them know that I was there, that I was somebody on the outside working to get them out as soon as possible. You know, so I worked the whole weekend and some on Saturday. So we started like Friday evening, and on Saturday there was some court cases. So I would run from the jail to the court to try to resolve issues to get some kids back to school. Mm-hmm. And then there was some on Sunday. So I spent my Sunday at the jail, and then running back over to the court to handle cases that were being tried. Mm-hmm. But most of the cases was being tried early Monday morning, starting about 8 or 9 o'clock.
Okay. And, now, question.
Yes, sir.
You you had sat down with the Gate City, and you talked to them, and everybody was in favor of doing this pro bono work. How many lawyers actually worked with you?
Zero. Wow. Nobody showed up.
Wow.
Nobody showed up. So I was a Lone Ranger. It was my idea. Everybody got scared because that was after we made the announcement. The mayor, you know, had several press conferences, and he was very adamant that he was opposed to Freaknik taking place in the city of Atlanta, that his officers were going to execute the law, and if there were violators, they would be arrested. You know, lawyers, always angling for another job, right?
Right.
You know, so
wow.
No one wanted to anger the mayor or be on the bad side of the mayor. I mean, for me, it wasn't a political question.
Mm-hmm.
It was a moral question. It wasn't right.
Right.
And if the kids came, you know, they needed help.
Right, right.
You know, and that's what, you know, lawyers are supposed to help. And sometimes you help people out of trouble and you can charge them and you make a living doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But at other times, you just have to do things for free.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what type of law did you practice?
I started my practice out as a personal injury lawyer, made mm-hmm. tons of money, settled in road wreck cases and, you know, some medical malpractice cases, slip and falls. I had, you know, a lot of lawyers, if it was a small case, they wouldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
They would snicker and say there wasn't enough money in it and say, Harvey, I'll take it. Harvey, you want this? Yeah, I want it. You know, so I was settling cases, you know, $8,000, $10,000, $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot of them.
Mm.
And the money was just rolling in. And then, you know, every now and then, on my own volition, I would get a good injury case on my own,
mm-hmm.
You know, and make substantial money. And usually in settlements, it's, you know, sometimes you have to try them. So I was doing that. And then I met during the time that I was the president of Gate City Bar Association, I invited Johnny Cochran to come to Atlanta and do a continuing legal education seminar on how do you represent an unpopular client. He had just finished representing successfully O.J. Simpson, and he agreed to come. And as a result of establishing a relationship with Johnny Cochran, you know, he would constantly getting calls from people from Georgia and California. And so he would have those people contact me. And so all of a sudden now I'm doing criminal work.
Okay.
But I started out primarily when I started, you know, 100% of my work was personal injury. And I worked very quietly. Nobody knew that I was in town. I would collect my clients. I would come into my office, set a file in my lap, pick up the telephone and call an insurance adjuster lawyer across town, and start negotiating the claim. And, you know, at some point in time, they hit the magic number. My client likes the magic number and, you know, we sold it out and we were in business. I roll on, pick up another file in my lap and, you know, go to work on that one. And I would do that day in and day out. And then suddenly I started doing criminal cases. I think I went downtown to represent a friend. And when I left out of the courtroom, I don't think I've got the decision that I wanted in representing that friend. But when I walked out of the courtroom, about two or three people rushed behind me and said, "Can I have your card?" And I'm surprised because I didn't think I got the result that I wanted.
Mm.
But what they saw was someone who, every time the judge pushed me, I pushed back on behalf of my client.
Mm.
And they said, no, you did a good job. You did a good job.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't like that. No. I got to have your card. And I said, well, I really don't do criminal work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I started doing a little bit after that, and so developed a good reputation for criminal defense in that I would at least stand up for my client, make sure that in the court, no matter what my client was charged with, no matter how hideous the crime was that brought him or her to court, that person was respected and referred to not as defendant, but as Mr. Jones or Mrs. Smith, or they were a human being and they
right,
had
right.
certain rights that needed to be protected.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so obviously you were doing well and didn't need to get involved in the, with the students and stuff. And then, so you do this pro bono work and so it ultimately, negatively impacted your career.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the mayor hated me for years, and his staff. I mean, I remember that was a husband and wife team. One worked in the city court system of Atlanta, and the wife worked over in DeKalb County, and I had cases pending in both of those courts and had drew both of them as solicitors in those cases. And they kept me running. They would never bring my case up. They would always have an excuse to the court why the case couldn't go forward. And sometimes my client would be languishing in jail. But the thing was, they wanted to establish, they wanted to prove to the public that I was a bad lawyer so that people wouldn't come to me and that my business would fail and my practice would fail. And I know, and I had this guy in the DeKalb system, and I couldn't get this guy's wife. I mean, I'd never done anything wrong to spoke out of turn to either one of them. But because the guy worked he was appointed to his position by the mayor, you know, the wife took umbrage, you know, of me when I appeared in her court. And I had a guy, he wasn't a student, but I ended up representing the guy who was arrested doing Freaknik. And he languished in jail for 2 or 3 weeks. And so finally he called me one day and said, "Miss Harvey, I'm out. Thank you for not doing anything to help me." He says, "A deputy in the jail was a Mason, and I'm Masonic, and I'm a Mason too. And I talked with him, and the guy got me out of jail." And, you know, so yeah, it didn't bode well for my career because, I stood up, to the mayor and to the power to be. And the mayor wasn't the only one in the area who didn't want the students to come. The governor didn't want them to come because, you know, some of the perimeter of the city, was manned, by state patrol officers. And they had these big concrete blocks. I don't think that the city could have those blocks, those concrete highway blocks that would block the exits off. That had to have come from the state.
Wow.
And, you know, so it wasn't, you know, people look at Freaknik and they laugh because of all of the lewd dancing that, you know, you may have seen some girls do and all the partying type atmosphere. But it was a very scary thing, and people didn't want it to happen. And, you know, you got this little lawyer that nobody ever heard of before standing up saying, well, it's not right to repress or oppress students, black students coming to town, just have a little fun for a couple of days and then get back to school.
And you represented like over 300 students, did you not?
Probably around 200 a year. And I may have done this for, 3-4 years, at least 3 years, probably four.
Wow.
And, you know, I figured around about 1998 or nine that if you were still coming to Atlanta the third weekend in April, you know, you should have heard by now that you weren't welcome.
Right.
And that you could possibly, you know, face some repression from the police. And, you know, so why, you know, I didn't want to spend my third weekend in April any longer, you know, providing a free service to somebody who should have learned from what happened in previous years, either not to come or to come in a different way.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because before I got a chance to talk to you, the last time I had watched the documentary, and I was like, wait a minute, I don't see Harold Michael Harvey anywhere in this thing. What's going on?
Completely whitewashed.
Yes.
Like that never happened.
Right. And as many, you know, as students as you worked with, as many as you helped, I thought that was, you know, it was of the utmost importance that they, one, interview you and get your take on what happened during that period of time, and two, you know, they definitely want to let people know that who this person is. Who is the Freaknik lawyer? You know, what was he all about? And you know, what did he go through as a result of helping all of these students?
Yeah, it wasn't an easy thing to do. I mean, the work was physically taxing because I remember that first year, I got up I had a sentencing in Northwest Georgia. I tried a case like in February. Mm-hmm. Sentencing was scheduled for the third Friday in April. And so I got up at 6 o'clock and got ready. I drove up to Northwest Georgia. And, you know, I think sometimes after lunch, they call my case and my guy was sentenced. And I get in the car and I drive back to Atlanta. But then when I get near the city, I'm now caught up in the traffic, in the Freaknik traffic. And it took me an hour to travel to get to my office at a spot where it used to take me about 5 to 7 minutes. Mm. Pull off the expressway and get to my office. It took me about an hour. I sit out there and then walk in and the phone rings and it's the SLC people saying, hey, you know, we've got Command Central set up. Why don't you come on down? And so I went down. As soon as I get there, you know, the first call comes in. Mm. So that's about six. So I've been up since six. Mm-hmm. So I leave Ozell Sutton's office, go down to the jail, and I stay there till about 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And for some reason, so I walk back and I get my car, and I don't know. I'm not thinking. Because I get on the expressway, I could have taken the surface streets, mm-hmm. but I get on the expressway. So now I'm in the soup again. And so on my way home, it took, I think I get home about 6 o'clock. I left about 3 a.m. And it takes me about six to get home. I got to be up at seven because my son's little league is having a parade and we got to leave the house by 7:30. Mm-hmm. So I get an hour's sleep. Dress to go to parade, attend the parade, come back home, dress again to go down to the jail, stay there till about 3 o'clock that morning, mm. which would have been early Sunday morning, go home, go to church, go back down there by 2 o'clock, stay again till about 3 o'clock in the morning, and then I'm up at 6 or 7, got to be in court at 8 on Monday. I get to my office at like 10 o'clock that night. So I've had very, very little sleep, maybe 3 hours, if that much. Mm-hmm. And I'm brain dead Monday morning when I've got to handle those cases. I mean, I have nothing inside of my head.
Right.
Enough to ask the court for leniency for this person. But yeah, so physically it was demanding. And it took a toll on my practice because people thought that to mistreat me is what the mayor wanted, although I'm pretty sure he never gave that order. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But if the mayor didn't like what he was doing, I'm going to mistreat him too. So it's sort of like, but yeah, that's, it happened. Mm. That was what my life was like.
Right.
But, you know, I'm just so stubborn, old Curtis. I don't.
Well,
if I feel compelled to do something, I do it.
Right.
I knew the consequences at Tuskegee. Hmm. And I remember I had a classmate that says, you know, you don't have to go through that hearing. Because in the morning of the hearing, the vice president of the university says to me, in fact, he shows me. He reaches into his credentials and pulls out a degree and says, Harold, I've got your degree right here. You can have it right now if you agree not to go to the hearing. And I said, well, I want to go think about it. I remember talking to a classmate who I still talk to today. And he says, maybe you should do it. And I remember telling him, I said, well, if I do it, if I cave in today, when I get out into the real world and I am confronted with a similar situation,
right,
I cave in. I says, I've got to be willing. If this is what I believe, I've got to be willing to stand on what I believe, no matter the consequences. And so I've always lived my life that way.
Right.
That no matter the consequences, if I believe passionately in something, I will stand for it, come hell or high water. And
same here.
Yeah, so they can't hurt me no matter what they do. They can't hurt me.
Yeah. If I'm right, I'm not backing down.
I'm not backing down. And and I'm right. Not. You can't punish me.
Right.
I laugh at you.
So at what point did you start writing?
Well, you know, I was a journalist. I held some newspaper jobs in addition to substitute teaching way back when I got out of school. And I actually had a column in the Campus Digest at Tuskegee. So I had a weekly column that was very popular. And that was how I was able to convince students that maybe we need to band together and fight this designation of Tuskegee as a national historical site. Well, of course, Tuskegee is today a national historical site. But I wrote against it, you know, very eloquently and finally around about, you know, October 1973, the student body came around and began to support my column and the things that were being expressed in those columns. So I've always written out of school. You know, one of the first jobs I was able to get was as a newspaper reporter, you know, so so I continued to write and but then after I closed my office, I really didn't know what to do with myself. You know, so my wife was ill and we were not initially sure of what the problem was, and the doctors didn't have a plan to address it. And then as she got better, you know, I did play a little golf. I really wasn't fulfilled. And so one night I'm surfing the internet and I see this contest. I think it was True TV, which may be Court TV today, or Court TV, which may be True TV today. They were looking for the next great mystery writer. And I said, wow, you know, I started this novel before I went to law school, Paper Puzzle. That was my first book. I said, you know, murder mystery, whodunit. You know, maybe I should enter the contest. And so I entered the contest. And, you know, it wasn't a completed novel because at some point I stopped writing when I went to law school and I didn't write on it any anymore. In fact, I left the manuscript, which at that point in time in the 1970s when I started, I left the manuscript at my mother's house in a shoebox. And I think 1999, I was there for Christmas or Thanksgiving, had dinner and was packing up, getting ready to come back to Atlanta. And my mom sauntered down the hallway with this little cigar box in her hand. She says, you know, son, I was in the attic the other day and I ran across your baseball cards. And she handed me this cigar box with my baseball cards in it, but my manuscript was in it too.
Oh, wow.
And she says, you know, your manuscript's in there. You say, you know, you never did finish that book. And I said, oh, you know, I'm going to finish it one day. And so I took it downtown and filed it away under P for Paper Puzzle and forgot about it. And then when some years later, when I'm closing out my practice around 2005, I'm waiting for people to come and pick up, lawyers to come and pick up files that had agreed that they would take on, take certain cases off my hands. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I'm in the P section, I come across paper puzzle. I said, well, you know, while I have time on my hand, I might as well drop this in the computer. So I said that I dropped it in the computer and I added a little more to it. I added a Civil War scene, to the book, and forgot it was in the computer. Mm. You know, packed up when that time came and came home. And then one night, I remember that I had started this novel, and it was a murder mystery, and I just may be the next great mystery writer. So I entered it. They wanted like the first 10 pages, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I entered it. And within a week or so, I get a call from the person handling the submissions. And the question was, Mr. Harvey, is this a finished novel, complete novel? It's not a short story. This is a novel. I said, yeah, it is a novel, but it's not complete. And so we're in like, I think I apply in November, and I get a call in early December, and the person says, well, we're going to make announcements in February, and we'll publish the winners in April. If you were one of the winners, can't tell you where you are, where we are in the process, but is it close enough that you could be finished in time for publication in April? And I said, nope. Well, you'll have to withdraw your submission.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I withdrew the submission. But this guy named Max, well-known writer, inspirational writer, can't think of the last name right now. But he had made a comment, and the only thing that he wanted to know was this novel set in the past, or was it, you know, present? And he gave me some pointers of, you know, about how to transition, or if I wanted to transition it into present. Hmm. So I was dejected. I didn't feel very well. I thought I had failed. And maybe a week or so later, I said, well, wait a minute, let's stop and think about this. Why did you get that call?
They must have seen something in it.
They saw something. They wanted to know, can you have it finished? Right. And my idea was, this started out as a serious, although it's a whodunit, but it started out as a serious literary work. And I didn't want to rush through it and just put something together and have an ending to it, because if I was going to pick it back up and finish it, it still had to have that serious literary tone that I had started out with. Mm. I have a section in the book that talks about what good writing is. So Paper Puzzle is a murder mystery that's told through the eyes of two journalists. One white journalist who works for the white daily paper, and a black journalist who works for the local black weekly paper. Mm-hmm. And they both have bits and pieces of this puzzle, but they can't solve the mystery because of the racial dichotomy of the 1970s South. You know, they have no association with each other, either professionally or personally. Mm. You know, so I'm trying to work them through this racial dichotomy so that they can come together and solve the mystery, right? Mm-hmm. And so I have the white protagonist describing what good writing is. And the way he describes what good writing is, he talks about, and you may remember this from baseball, the 1977 World Series, or maybe it was a 78 World Series, New York Yankees versus Los Angeles Dodgers. In the eighth or ninth inning of the game one night, Reggie Jackson comes up and hits a home run, and the Yankees win. His first at-bat the next night, on the very first pitch again, he hits the ball out of the ballpark. The Yankees win. His next at-bat, he hits the very next first pitch out of the ballpark. The Yankees win. And so the journalist says that good writing is just like that. It gets to the point, and it has this finality to it that the outcome is no longer in dispute. It's like a three-run homer onslaught by Reggie Jackson. And, you know, so it's a good literary work in addition to being a whodunit. Now, the irony of it is that I come to my wife several months later, and I say to her, you know, I think if I could get a cabin in the mountains, I could finish this novel in a year. But I got to go to the mountains by myself, live like a hermit for a year. She says, without thinking, if you think you can do it, go for it. And so we went up and we found a place that we could afford for me to stay in, very spare, sparse. And I was on a short budget. And so I had my son rig me this laptop that didn't have any internet capabilities. And, you know, it took it about 15, 20 minutes to warm up. So every morning at 2 a.m. on the dot, even if I stayed up to 12 or 1 o'clock, my internal clock went off at 2 o'clock. I got up, plugged in the laptop, went into the little kitchen and fixed a pot of coffee, made the coffee. By that time, the laptop is warmed up. Pull it up, pull the story up, and go to work. My goal was 1,000 words a day.
Okay.
And I would, when the sun is coming up and starts peeping in through the curtains, through the shades, I would do a word count. And if I had 800 words, I would keep going. If I had 900 words, I would keep going. Sometimes I would end up with 1,500 words. Sometimes 1,200, 1,100. Sometimes I hit 9,000 words on the head and quit. And one morning, you know, I come to this point and it was like, Eureka, that's the end. And the voice says, that's your story. And I typed the end and I jumped up and the sun was out and like the mountains that were surrounding me were jumping and I was shouting. It's just like I had given birth to a baby. Wow. And lo and behold, guess how long it took me to finish that novel?
How long?
4 months.
So you could have did it.
Dang. I could have. Yeah. I think conditions had to be right.
I'm sure.
It was necessary for me to come to realize that under the right climate with no distractions, you know, and my wife was, every bill, every problem, everything that broke in the house, she fixed it. And she didn't call me and say the washing machine broke or the cable bill was more than, or the phone bill was more than we expected and I don't know what to do. I mean, she took care of it. She didn't call and say whatever her problems were. It was in running a household. She just took care of business and kept all of that pressure off me. As far as I knew, everything was fine.
Wow.
And everything was fine.
Right.
I get back home and we debriefed. Everything wasn't fine, but she took care of it and didn't disturb me, didn't disturb my peace. She allowed me the opportunity to work through it to see if I could do it, and I did it.
Wow.
Paper Puzzle had a good run. I'm thinking about reissuing it soon. It's a good story. Timely story. And
wow.
When the Trump saga finally reaches its conclusion, I guarantee it's going to be the same conclusion in Paper Puzzle.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of interesting. You had to go up to the mountains. I went to, some years back, I went to Frederick Douglass's house in Southeast D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been there?
I have. My mom has, but I haven't.
Okay. Yeah, I was first there in mid-70s, like 77, I think. Wow. 76, 77.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, the caretaker of the property, because at that juncture, it wasn't taken over by the feds yet. So the caretaker of the property happened to be a family member of mine that I didn't know. And
wow.
So I met him that day, and we went in and we saw the place, and you know, just was marveling over you know what he had during that period of time. But what really struck me is when we went outside in the back, and he had what he called a growly, which is just like a little small one room. I can't even, it's kind of difficult to describe, but basically inside is just a desk and a bed,
mm-hmm.
and nothing else, a lantern and you know, nothing else. And that's where he used to go and write,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you got this big, huge house there, but he had to leave out of the house and go into the growlery. And that's where he did all his writing and stuff. And I was like, you know what? At some point I'm gonna get me a growlery.
There you go. It'll bring out the creativity in you. I mean,
yeah.
it did for me.
Man, oh, I know that's right. Yeah, I don't know that I could go up into the mountains, but, you know, I'm sure that wow.
I had some experiences up there. And in fact, one of the residents gave me a U.S. Marine decal to put on my side of my door,
mm-hmm.
Because the people got angry. And so I'm up there in 2008, and Barack Obama is running for president.
Mm.
You know, so, and of course me, I walk practically everywhere I went. But after I'd been there for maybe about 3 months, I got this car. You know, I bought a car from somebody for may have been a dollar.
No, oh, wow.
I think that's what I paid for. I think I paid a dollar for the car.
Uh-huh.
But before that time, I walked everywhere. And of course, me, my spirit, I'm a free black man.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter where I am, that's how I roll.
Mm.
You know, and so that bothered some people.
Oh, I'm sure.
Now, who does he think he is?
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably... Sure, they didn't say he. You know.
Oh, yeah. Had to throw that N-word up in there.
Yeah, you know, but, you know, I'm free.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter where I am, I'm free. And no matter what the circumstances that comes with being free, mm-hmm. I'm willing to live through them,
mm-hmm.
Or not. You know, with this guy, for my protection, he says, you know, maybe they'll back off. They do respect veterans.
Oh, okay.
You know, so I kept it on my car for a while, even after I got back here. And my wife said, well, why are you doing that? And it really made her afraid because she realized how dangerous it had gotten for me up there.
Oh, right.
Yep. But, yeah. Hey, we got it done. And, I want to be able to go back because I have a sequel and I haven't written on it in years. But, you know, she says no every time. I mean, she didn't give it a thought the first time. But she will not give me permission to go back to any place if she can't go. So,
mm-hmm.
And I know I can't do it if I've got to worry about family and
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Stopping to get her dinner, because I'm not going to stop to get dinner. I mean, I just keep going.
Just keep going.
Right. I'll eat whenever, or I'll sleep whenever. But if the muse hit, you know, I'm there for the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you do most of your writing at night or
in the early morning? From 2 to probably 2 to 7. Wow. She was working a job at that time, and so what I would do is I would call her before she left for work, mm-hmm. and I would read her what I had done, and then she would give me some suggestions. She would say, "Well, you might need to flush that scene out a little bit more, or tell me more about that character and how that character relates to whatever." And you know, so then you know, I would take the day and go. That was this car dealership I would hang out in. That's what I was. They liked me at the car dealership, and a guy, somebody came in and traded this little car. And I think the car, the guy had given the car to his daughter, and she had run it into the ground. And they gave the guy $1 for the car. So I went in and asked the guy for the car. And I says, "Well, can I pay you whatever it is you gave the trade-in value you gave the guy for the car?" He said, "I don't know. So we only gave the guy $1 for the car. And, you know, we're going to run it through service, and we're going to, you know, change the oil, and, you know, we're going to fix it up and get it serviceable. Mm-hmm. We're going to have some expense in it." I said, "Well, yeah, but, you know, pay the $1 for it." So he, you know, guy sold me the car for $1.
Wow.
You know, so that, you know, they had this big fountain, like one of the fountains that you would see in Italy. In fact, the wallpaper in this dealership, the guy had built this humongous, well, I take it, he didn't build it. I think the building he was in had been a Walmart, had been a Walmart store or a Costco's or some type of store like that. Mm-hmm. And, so he had taken his walls and put Italian wallpaper on it, and had actually imported this fountain from Italy and mm-hmm. put it in so like the center of the showroom. Wow. And he had his cars around. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would come and sit around the fountain, and he had a movie theater. And I would come and sit around the fountain, and, you know, salespeople would come up, and they could always get a good word of wisdom that would inspire them to go out and make a sale or talk to their customers. And so they kind of liked me. So that's why he gave me the car. So I would use that time sitting around that fountain trying to figure out whatever it is my wife had told me about, you know, that day. And then I would go back home and, you know, figure out dinner and go to bed and, you know, get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, write again, write another day.
Right.
You know, go hang out at the fountain, go and look at the theater, get some popcorn and watch, you know, a football game on Sundays or something, you know, because I didn't have television.
Right.
So that would be the entertainment I would allow myself to have.
Mm-hmm. And now, how many books have you written?
I believe 6 now.
Okay.
You know, so I had Paper Puzzle, Justice in the Round, Freaknik Lawyer, My C.T. Vivian Story. Mm-hmm. So that's C.T. Vivian Over My Shoulders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, C.T. was one of M.L. King's lieutenants.
Right.
Say, you know, he was a general in his own right. In fact, you know, he was doing nonviolent sit-ins in Peoria, Illinois, before Martin went to Morehouse.
Oh, wow.
And so after he had finished, after Vivian finished college, he went over to work in the publishing house, the Baptist publishing house that's in Nashville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. He's a Baptist minister. And he met James Lawson, who died 2 days ago in California.
Oh, wow.
Civil rights leader, James Lawson, Reverend mm-hmm. Lawson, United mm-hmm. Methodist Church minister. So they had this triumphant Diane Nash C.T. Vivian, James Lawson, and Zenobia Clayton. So in this picture here, you see Zenobia Clayton straightening C.T. Vivian's tie.
Oh, okay. And yeah, I was wondering what that was behind you.
And so the tie is the tie that he has on in the picture.
Wow.
So when C.T. died the year of the pandemic, and when he died, one of his daughters, he has four daughters, one of his daughters came up and brought me a tie and said, I thought you would want to have something to dance.
Wow.
And a couple weeks later, she came back and says, I found a picture of Dad wearing a tie that I gave you. And I said, oh, you did? She said, would you like to have it? I says, yes. And so I took it and put it in a frame, the tie. I put the tie on. I was going to wear it to church one Sunday. And
no, couldn't do it.
Not worthy.
Yeah, I hear you. Not worthy. And now you, I think you told me that was one of your neighbors as well, right?
Yeah, he was my neighbor, lived up the street from me for 27 years. We talked all the time. And until the last 4 or 5 years of his life, I knew, you know, I didn't know when, but I knew his time was numbered. You know, the further we get, I mean, I'm 72, I'll be 73 this year. So I knew I'm working on the last 25.
Okay.
You know, so I sort of respected his time, and I wouldn't go as often. And it was at the point in time that he could no longer come down here. He would come and knock on my door early in the morning, and we would sit around and have coffee and explore whatever his ideas were. Sometimes he would knock on my door, and one morning he says, Brother Harper, I just couldn't wait for daybreak.
Wow.
I said, why? He said, man, I thought about you all night. You did? Yeah. I mean, he's this iconic figure. I mean, he thought about me all night. And I says, why? He says, I want you to read this article. Come on in, Doc. So I got the coffee pot on, and he brought me this article. And it talked about the Williams father, Serena and
Venus.
And Venus's father talked about how he started on this track of teaching them tennis at such an early age. And that Mr. Williams was talking about what you needed in order to get more Black girls and guys to play in tennis is you needed a tennis academy. And so Vivian, like me and like you, loved baseball. And so, you know, we talked about how we had this baseball academy. He knew that I had started a baseball academy in the 90s when I was coaching my son. And of course, when it came down to this period of me having to close my office and so forth, I sort of let the baseball academy, you know, go. And he comes back around 2010-ish and say, I think we need to revive your idea. And you know, we could steer these Black young men, you know, into baseball. And you know, not only the play on the field, but also the front office jobs that the baseball, you know, provides. And so we were working on that and had identified a venue. Morris Brown has a baseball field where they also play football. But they've got dugouts over there, and I played it on that baseball on that field when Tuskegee would play Morris Brown. And in fact, in 1973, the Southern Intercollegiate Athletic Conference had an all-star game where the conference all-stars played my Tuskegee team because we were the conference champions.
And so
we played in that stadium. And in the 1950s, Jackie Robinson would bring barnstorming teams of Black major league players to play white major league players. And they played over at Herndon Field over at Morris Brown College. And so when the Olympics used that venue for some of their practice exercises, and they actually went in to the clubhouse and redid the weight room redid the medical facilities
wow.
in there, and it was a state of the art. Okay, so we identified that, and we were going to work on seeing if we could obtain that facility to run the baseball academy in. And then by 2012, Barack Obama appoints him, at least designate him, gives him the award of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And so then he sort of changed what is it he wanted his legacy to be. He didn't want to spend the time to do that. He wanted, he had an opportunity now to develop the C.T. Vivian Institute. And so he created this institute that bears his name and his wife's name.
What was the focus of the institute?
A library.
Oh, okay.
Every book written by a Black author.
Wow.
Yes. It will be a repository of every book in this country written by a Black American.
Okay.
Now, he was a book collector. And in his lifetime, he had the largest collection of original autograph books of any book collector in the Southeast. May have been close to being number one in the country.
Wow.
He had books everywhere.
Oh, I'm sure. Wow. Hey, I got a series of rapid fire questions.
Okay.
All right. Let's go there. What are your hobbies?
Photography.
Okay. Black and white, color, digital.
Digital now, but in the old days, I developed my own black and white.
Oh yeah.
I don't think I learned the technique of developing color back in the old day, but I did my black and whites.
Yeah, that was a lot harder process.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did black and white as well.
One of my first ones. Those are my grandparents. So it's 1977. I took the picture and I developed the picture.
Okay. What is the greatest accomplishment of your life?
I don't know. I know the thing that made me the happiest.
What's that?
The day I got married.
Okay. Okay.
Man, did I have my chest puffed up? I walked around with my chest stuck out all day.
We did. We did.
No best doubt. Decision I ever made.
What's on your bucket list?
I don't really have a bucket list. I like to do whatever it is I like to do.
Okay.
But one of the things I have not done in my lifetime is I have not done a great deal of travel. So I would like to travel more. I'd like to visit more places and more places outside of the country than I have.
It was just something that I love to do. I love to travel.
And I would like to write the next great American novel.
Okay.
I set out in the 1970s to do that. I think Paper Puzzle was close. But I would like to write the next great American novel.
What makes you unique?
Unafraid. I'm not afraid.
Right.
And my ability to accept consequences, good or bad.
Who is your hero?
C.T. Vivian.
Okay.
Love that man.
What is the most important decision you've ever made to date?
Marrying my wife. Most important decision I ever made.
What's your favorite song?
If I Were a Magician by Lou Rawls. Well, I don't know if Lou Rawls wrote the song, but he sang a good version of it.
Okay. Yeah, that man, my father put me on to Lou Rawls back in the 60s, and I love Lou Rawls. It's funny, as a kid, I used to hear Lou Rawls with the big orchestra and stuff, you know. So there was, you know, da 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 ba da ba ba da 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 da, you know. So the first time I heard Autumn Leaves, it was with this big orchestra.
Wow.
So fast forward maybe 2 years later, I hear someone else doing Autumn Leaves with a trio. And I'm like, oh, as a kid, I'm like, oh, no, it doesn't go like that. There's no orchestra. You only got a piano, bass, and drums. Where's the rest of the band? But yeah, so I always wanted to sing behind the orchestra after watching Lou Rawls, or listening to Lou Rawls, I should say, all those Lou Rawls records.
He didn't just do it simple. I mean, he really gave you the whole orchestration.
Oh, man. It was beautiful, too. I don't know who did the arrangements, but they did great arrangements. And his voice just came right through and stuff, you know. Another thing about Lou Rawls that I didn't realize until maybe about 10 years ago is, I mean, I knew that he and Sam Cooke were real good friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd come up together and stuff. And so... there's that one song that Sam Cooke did, and I listened to the song, man, 1,000 times probably, and didn't realize it was Lou Rawls singing background. Bringing Her Home to Me.
Oh wow, yes,
I didn't know that was Lou Rawls singing background. You know, cause, and when I went back, when I found out and went back and listened to it, you could clearly hear his voice and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that was a fact I had known, but I had forgotten.
Mm.
But you're exactly right. That is it.
The last of the quick hitters. Tell me your life story in one sentence.
Passion. Oh, one sentence, not a word. Mm-hmm. One sentence.
One sentence. You say passion. If you put exclamation on it, ain't that a...
At an early age, he learned that the secret to life is to have no fear.
Wow. That's deep. I like that. I like that. How can people contact you on social media?
HaroldMichaelHarvey.com.
Okay.
In addition to HaroldMichaelHarvey.com, of course, I'm on LinkedIn as... I think Harold Michael Harvey on X.
X.
H. Michael Harvey, I think. And that's how, but primarily HaroldMichaelHarvey.com. My name.com. I'm a .com.
Well, okay.
MichaelHarvey.com. In fact, all my books are online at HaroldMichaelHarvey.com.
Yeah, I got to go in because I'm real curious. I only have one of the books so far, so I got to go in and start getting some more of them. So I'm going to do that. But I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and giving me another shot after I blew it so badly and stuff with the technology the first time around.
Man, it's always a pleasure talking with you, whether it's on a podcast or just talking personally.
Pleasure's all mine, and I'm glad we got a chance to talk on the podcast. But as I said to you when I first called you, I said, I'm going to wear out my welcome, Doc. I'm going to wear out my welcome because I really appreciate you, man.
Yeah. Any topic, you've got a current national, international topic that you want to explore, call me.
Okay, I'll do that. I'll do that.
I do have a degree in political science.
Right.
TV Institute, and they put you through the ringer down there.
No, I know that's right. Well, once again, thank you so much, bro. I appreciate you, man.
Oh, God bless you. Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of In the Black of My Mind podcast. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe, and share. Until next week, y'all be blessed.